the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
You're welcome back to The Last Word. It's Ian Guider in for Matt today. It is Wednesday, so it's time for our Culture Club, and our newest member is the author Andrew Meehan. Andrew, you're very welcome into The Last Word. You've got your new book out called Best Friends, your fourth novel, just come out this month. We'll get onto all of your picks for your movies and books and TV choices and your music choice in just a few moments. But tell us a little bit about this book, because I've seen one reviewer call it Normal People for Pensioners.
Yes, that's one of the phrases that's landing with people. Best Friends is a romantic comedy, really, but it's a romantic comedy featuring a couple who meet in their 70s. They live in Sandy Cove in County Dublin, as everyone knows, is an affluent suburb. But they are, I suppose, slight outsiders in that part of the world, because they're not affluent. They are the character of June is a house cleaner. Ray is a janitor in the tennis courts. So in a way, they're sort of outsiders in that world. And because they're slightly older, they're almost sort of outsiders to the notion of falling in love. They think they have no expectations, really, that love is for them anymore. So whatever happens in the book is a surprise to them.
It's a strange way to say that, like, normal people for pensioners, because love grows across any generation.
Indeed. And I suppose, I mean, I...
And many different divides as well.
And many different particulars, because I think society tends to sort of flatten or homogenize the experience of anyone of 60 plus as having the same type of experience. So I really wanted to address what it is particularly like to be 70 plus, to be on your own, to be maybe living in a life of a quiet life, maybe a life of quiet desperation. And I wanted just to see to consider the question of, what is it like to fall in love when perhaps society thinks you're beyond it?
It's a theme throughout all of the novels you've written so far.
Love is definitely something I've paid attention to. My first novel was about an amnesiac. My second book was called The Mystery of Love. I suppose I was letting on there, and that was about the marriage, the complicated marriage of Constance Wilde and Oscar Wilde. That was from Constance's point of view. And my third book, my last book before this one, is a book called Instant Fires, which is a German set love story between an Irish man and a German woman. So I do like to write about people falling. It's a nice experience to be in as a writer, to be in that experience of people falling in love.
The setting for this novel, as you said, is around in and around South Dublin, Sandy Cove and Dunleary, which is somewhere you grew up as well.
I lived there until I was 13, and I then moved to Scotland, where I live now. And I've lived in between Ireland and Scotland my whole life, bouncing back and forth. So there was the first time I've ever actually set anything in Ireland, four books in. And I really wanted to, again, consider that experience of feeling like an outsider where you're from. Because when I go back to Sandy Cove now, I was there this morning, and I don't feel like I quite fit in, because it's partly socioeconomic. I don't have the moolah. And I think Ray and June, best friends, they're from there, but they're not quite of the place anymore. They're peripheral characters in the place where they're from. And I do have that slight feeling myself when I go back to Dunleary and Sandy Cove and Glasthill, that it's not quite for me anymore.
Well, let's start with some of your picks, and it'll probably tell us a bit more about your life back in Ireland, also in Scotland. From childhood, what type of music were you into?
Well, I was into what my brothers were into. I've got older siblings, three older brothers and an older sister, and there was a lot of music in the house, but I had no choice in what went on. So I listened to whatever I was given. So I listened to my older siblings' record collection.
And one of the things that you were into was Bruce Springsteen, who's still very much in the news in the last couple of weeks.
He certainly is, and it's great. He's an inspiring character. His song Thunder Road. I mean, you're going to hear me use the word wistful a lot today. You know, bittersweet, tender, longing, these kind of things. And these are the words I use to describe best friends. But his song Thunder Road is a song that evokes those feelings of kind of wistfulness.
Let's have a listen to it.
Somehow
That is Bruce Springsteen, of course, with Thunder Road. You mentioned, of course, that your childhood, you moved between Ireland and Scotland. Did your musical taste change at all when you moved to Scotland?
Well, I had to sort of go out on my own because I was living on my own. My parents and my older siblings weren't around anymore, so I had to find my own records. So I was always very, very curious about. This was pre-internet, of course, in the mid '80s. So I was very curious about whatever was in the NME or whatever was in Melody Maker and whatever I could get my hands on. So I very much got into, music from all around the world, but a lot of Scottish music too.
How is it growing up in Scotland? Your parents are Scottish, I think, isn't it? And how is that growing up as an Irish person in Scotland?
I moved there when I was 13, and it felt very odd. My parents were Scottish. I was an Irish kid at school in Glasgow. It wasn't in any way a traumatic experience, but it was an odd. I very much felt like a fish out of water. So all my life I have, and now I'm back living in Glasgow again. So in a way now I'm almost nostalgic for what it was like to be a teenager in Glasgow missing Dublin. So I'm nostalgic for my own nostalgia.
Let's talk again about some more of your choices. We've asked you to pick your favourite album, and obviously over the years growing up in the 80s and 90s, there was lots of different musical tastes for you.
Indeed. And the Blue Nile are they're a Glaswegian band, and people maintain that they're a very Glasgow band, but I'm not entirely sure what that means, because Glasgow isn't really a city that's culturally is known for its tenderness. But Hats, the album I'm talking about here, which is one of my favourite records of all time, has got that kind of urban melancholy that feels very Glasgow. It's got kind of handsome, kind of Victorian architecture. It's always raining. Maybe you're walking home from a night out. It might have been a good night. Perhaps it wasn't. But you have this kind of perfect, kind of dreamy soundtrack. And I don't know. Will I get removed from the building if I use the word dreamscape? But it does. When you're listening to the Blue Nile, you do feel like you're in your own movie. You might be deluded, of course, but you're in your own movie, and they're the soundtrack to it. And it feels. But it's a record that is so emotionally potent for me that I only really try and put it on once a year. I tried to listen to it this morning in preparation for this, and I had to put it off because it's so emotionally potent.
Let's have a listen to Headlights on the Parade by the Blue Nile. Albums and songs like that figure into your writing career? Were you always drawn to songs and music that you thought, wow, those lyrics are something that I could, in my writing, take inspiration from?
Really and truly. But it's also, it's an impossibility. It's a fallacy. How do you kind of capture a melody on the page? And you capture the melody, I suppose, in the way you arrange language and all the rest of it. But that song, Headlights on the Parade, and others on the record, like the song Downtown Lights, I really, really think they do inform my work. In fact, in Downtown Lights, there's a lyric that goes, "How do I know you feel it? How do I know it's true?" And people who know the Blue Nile will know that song. And for anyone who writes love stories, that's a very, very telling line, because I mean, my book Best Friends is very much about that kind of telepathy that's described in that lyric, "How do I know you feel it?" Because that telepathy that occurs when people are falling in love.
Were you much of a gig goer in your youth in Glasgow?
I really was. I went to anything and everything. And Glasgow is a city, because it's a city with, it's different. I mean, Glasgow is different from Edinburgh, and Glasgow's got very much a kind of a more working class energy. It's got more of a sense of cultural vitality, I would say. I mean, people from Edinburgh might differ, but Glasgow is very much about, it's got a very famous venue, the Glasgow Barrowland, and I went to everything and anything when I was a teenager. I'd go to gigs all the time, and there's an awful lot of, it's a very, very diverse scene, very, very supportive. And actually in my 20s there, which I might call my misspent youth, I spent more time hanging around to people in bands than people who were writers. I didn't know any writers at all, but I knew loads of people in bands.
Let's tell our listeners about your favourite gig.
And my favourite gig goes a little bit back, a little bit further back to the 80s. And I was a, let's say, a curious kid, quite curious in my habits as well. And there was a BBC documentary in the mid-80s about what they call New Country. And I got very into artists like Lyle Lovett and Nancy Griffith. And I know Nancy Griffith was very big in Ireland at the time. So if you permit me a little anecdote, it was 1986. It was May, round about this time of year. I just finished the equivalent of the Inter, the O-levels. And I took myself on my own off to the Queen's Howl in Edinburgh. And I sat in the front row with this kind of young enthusiast. And you'll know Nancy Griffith's fan base were or are middle-aged. But I remember when she walked on stage, she seemed a little bit startled to find this teenager looking at her from the front row. And I'd like to think she was amused, and that seemed to continue all the way through the show. She was kind of checking in with me, asking, like, wondering, was I okay almost? And that was a lovely night. I mean, she, as many people know, she died a year or two ago. I also get the impression that the ending of her life had a certain sadness attached to it. But I'd like to think that night in May 1986 in the Edinburgh Queen's Hall was an unexpectedly good night for her.
Well, let's have a listen to Nancy Griffith and Once in a Very Blue Moon. And this is live.
No need to tell me you'd like to be friends. Help me get back on my feet again. And if I miss you, well, it's just now and then. Just once in a very blue moon. Just once in a very blue moon. Just once in a very blue moon, and I'll be one coming on soon. There's a blue moon shining when I have reminded of all we've been through. Such a blue moon shining, does it ever shine down on you? You act as if it like I'm the only one who's getting up from a fall. Don't you remember? Can't you recall? Just once in a very blue moon. Just once in a very blue moon. Just once in a very blue moon. And there'll be one coming on soon.
That is Nancy Griffith. Once in a Very Blue Moon. Andrew, do you find yourself attracted to music that with a very upbeat tone, given the kind of themes in your book?
I say you might guess that, I'd say it's easy to discern that I like stuff with a reasonably melancholy, downbeat, wistful tone of longing. I mean, the characters in my book, Best Friends, are daydreamers. They are outsiders from society, peripheral in that way, and they do a lot of sort of daydreaming themselves towards life. So my taste tends to be a little bit more wistful, a little bit more reflective.
Are you still a gig goer in Glasgow? It's a great scene over there.
It is a great scene. I love going to, as I mentioned, the Glasgow Barland. I saw bands like the Young Fathers recently. I remember a few years ago, Bob Dylan put on a secret show there. It's the kind of you would go to see any show in the Barland just because of the venue more than the people who are playing there. Although of course Young Fathers and Bob Dylan are a great attraction. So yeah, it's very much a people go out in Glasgow.
We're going to talk after the break about your favourite choices of books and movies and films. But I should mention to people that you've actually worked in the TV industry, particularly here in Ireland.
I worked, yeah, in and around in script development, what they call script development, for quite a long time. And I worked for, I suppose, most notably at the Irish Film Board for a number of years in the early part of this decade. And, you know, working with writers, supporting their work. And it was working with writers in that regard that sort of led me towards writing fiction. But you know, I had a really, really good time. Well, working at the Irish Film, but they're now called Screen Ireland. But it was a really, really significant and formative part of my career.
How, growing up, did you look at the world of movies and TV? Were you somebody who was just drawn to it? I love great stories, or were you there? Oh, I'll just throw on anything, cartoons or whatever.
Well, I suppose, like many teenagers, I was a bit of a loner. I was a bit of a lonely kid. I was living in suburbia, so films and books and movie and music was a way just to sort of dream your way into the world. So it was. I had no idea, you know, as a teenager, that you might one day get to be involved in the making of films or the writing of novels. I thought that was something done by other people. They were something holy and sacred to me at the time, and they still are to a certain extent. But I thought it was, the writing of books was done by other people.
What type of movies were you drawn to?
I've always loved comedies. I've always loved romantic comedies. And I suppose Best Friends is a romantic comedy. And then the film I'm going to talk about probably is, you know, before the genre was really coined. I think it might even be called a sort of a proto-romantic comedy.
Yeah, and tell us about this movie, because a lot of people will know it. It's Gregory's Girl, and it's directed by Bill Forsyth. But this is something, think of, you know, a lot of people think of 80s movies are set in, like Breakfast Club, set in America. But this was a Scottish film that still endures today.
It endures today. I don't know if the film has entirely aged very well. The soundtrack is a bit ropey. Some of the secondary characters, some of their behaviour is a little bit questionable. It's very much a film of its time. But I'm still drawn to it because it's, for various reasons, it's set in suburban Glasgow, and I've always been drawn to those kind of suburban stories. And it's got that kind of everyday dreamy quality you'll find in the Blue Nile music. But the main character, Gregory, he's an enthusiast. In that regard, he's a model for Ray and Best Friends, because he doesn't do much wrong, but he doesn't do much right either. People wonder, look, who is this guy? And I think he's just a bit of a daydreamer. And there's a scene towards the end of the film where Gregory is lying on the grass in the summer with a character who's played by Claire Grogan, who people will know. And you just feel, when you're looking at this film, they have their whole lives in front of them. But it also might be that night at the end of that in this film, this might be for Gregory as good as it's ever going to get.
Let's have a clip from it.
Whoa, whoa, go easy with the sugar, lady.
Food, food, food. Is that all you think about? You're unnatural, pal. You're a freak.
You eat it, don't you? I've never seen you turn your nose up at anything I've made. Hours and hours I spent making you lovely, lovely things. And all it means to you in the end is food.
Look, pal, I don't know whether you've noticed, but I'm going through a crisis.
Of course I've noticed. But what do you want me to do? The whole world's got problems. You're just obsessed by a beautiful, young, unattainable girl. So what?
Stop saying things like obsessed and unattainable. It's love.
OK, it's love. Go and attain her then. Sweep her off her feet. Oh, I forgot, you're the goalkeeper. She's a sweeper.
Ha ha.
Look, one key question. Have you spoken to her? Asked her for a date? Anything? Well, do it, then complain.
If I got a date, can I borrow your white jacket?
No.
We always think of those teen coming-of-age angst movies being American, but this, of course, being Scottish. Was it reflective of life around you at the time?
Well, I actually saw it when I was still living in Ireland. I'm going way back. I saw it on a double bill, I think, at the Screen Cinema, on a double bill with Chariots of Fire and Gregory's Girl. I think I was 11 and it was a 15 film. And I remember feeling very daring that, in fact, I'd gone on to see a 15 film. But I've revisited it a lot over the years. And it does sort of encapsulate even that clip you showed about, you know, about the people, you know, that you're in love with are unattainable. It encapsulates that feeling of longing that a lot of the best romantic comedies have.
Now, as you said to me, you didn't think when you were young you would be growing up to be a writer or involved in the TV and film industry. So what type of books did you read?
Well, I everything and everything. I read whatever was on my parents' bookshelf. So I read a lot of poetry. I read a lot of sort of their book club fiction. I remember reading a lot of Somerset Maugham. I read whatever my parents had. I read Edna O'Brien. I read F. Scott Fitzgerald. And then, you know, I started to explore my own tastes. But I read whatever was going. Again, this is pre-internet. So you really had to find the object, the artifact, and you had to read what was there.
Now, your favourite book and the one you've chosen for us is something I've read a couple of times myself, and it's part of a long series by Richard Ford about a character called Frank Bascombe. And it is The Sports Writer, and it is an amazing book and one which, as I said, I've returned to a couple of times. What about it for you stands out?
I could go on and on. I mean, the character of Frank Bascombe, he's thoughtful, he's wistful, he's wise, and those attributes, thoughtfulness, wistfulness, wisdom, they're great things to aspire to. I mean, I don't know if you could look at the pages of my work and see Richard Ford's influence, but he's a writer I find inspiring and influential, just in terms of his tone and his worldview, and in terms of the personality on the page. But in particular, there's a scene quite early on in The Sports Writer where Frank Bascombe goes on a reporting trip with his new girlfriend Vicky. You know, he's going to cover a story, and they're upbeat and they're setting off and they're giddy and they're off to a hotel for the night. And then they check into this anonymous Midwestern hotel, and they're there in the afternoon, and things just start to slide. It's almost like a Blue Nile song. Twilight sets in and the kind of optimism drifts away. And I call that hotel sadness. And there's a chapter in Best Friends where the characters go on holiday to Venice and they experience something similar. Because Venice is a kind of place that almost, because it's so emblematic that it almost guarantees disappointment. You know, the gap between our reality and expectations. And I think the sports writer and all of Richard Ford's work explores that the kind of shortfall between optimism and optimism becoming very quickly becoming regret.
Yeah, let's have a clip from The Sports Writer by Richard Ford.
My life over these 12 years has not been and isn't now a bad one at all. In most ways, it's been great. And although the older I get, the more things scare me, and the more apparent it is to me that bad things can and do happen to you, very little really worries me or keeps me up at night. I still believe in the possibilities of passion and romance, and I would not change much, if anything at all. I might not choose to get divorced, and my son, Ralph Bascom, would not die, but that's about it for these matters. Why, you might ask, would a man give up a promising literary career, there were some good notices, to become a sports writer? It's a good question. For now, let me say only this. If sports writing teaches you anything, and there's much truth to it as well as plenty of lies, it is that for your life to be worth anything, you must sooner or later face the possibility of terrible, searing regret. Though you must also manage to avoid it, or your life will be ruined. I believe I have done these two things. Faced down regret. Avoided ruin. And I'm still here to tell about it.
That, of course, is The Sports Writer book. It falls into one of those great American novel cliches. Have you ever been tempted to write about the great American novel yourself rather than the characters of Ireland that you know?
No, well, I think America is full of American writers, so I'll have to. There's enough of them over there. I wouldn't mind writing the quite good Glass Tool novel. How about that?
Let's move on to your TV picks. So, what have you been watching in recent years?
Well, I watch all the big shows that everyone watches, but there's a show that I've been watching, and it really was influential again in putting together Best Friends. Is a show called Somebody Somewhere.
Which is fairly recent. It's only been the last couple of years.
Yes, and it kind of was it under the radar or not? But it's on HBO, so it's not exactly
a quiet hit.
No, it's not arcane in any way. But it does in much the same way because of their age. The characters in Best Friends are what you call peripheral people. Somebody Somewhere also features, I think, characters who are on the margins. They're, you know, ordinary people. It's about a character played by Bridget Everett who travels home after a family tragedy. The setup is sort of quite familiar, but there is something about it that really, when I watched Somebody Somewhere, I knew why I wanted to try and achieve that same kind of feeling in Best Friends. I wanted to achieve that feeling of it's silly, it's sad, it's throwaway, it's real. I remember texting a screenwriter friend about it, and my friend said, "This show is so good, it would never get made over here." And I think she meant that Somebody Somewhere is a show that which, you know, story is more important than plot, as in it's a show about characters more than events and incidents.
Yep, and we have a clip from the trailer to season 3 of Somebody Somewhere.
French toast for the table?
Absolutely.
No. We're going to get the body moving. All you need is a glove and a great attitude.
Well, I don't have either one of those.
I have a date.
I just poured you a glass of wine.
You can have it.
I don't like Pinot Grigio.
Hi.
Some big news. I got an offer on my house. You're cool with it, right?
Well, it's just a lot of change.
Hey, we're going to have a lot of fun at the new house.
What's next? Fun nails, tight perm, fake tits. I don't really know what I'm doing. What's wrong with wanting a little bit more?
You are a woman who is in charge of her life, but you have to manifest it. You have to say it out loud, otherwise it won't happen.
My life is so much better because of you.
That might be the nicest thing anybody's ever said to me.
I love people, it's like my thing now.
Nobody knows what they're doing. I promise. You just do it.
Hey, we're family.
Family is family, and friends are family, and you gotta love them all.
Do I?
That is the trailer from season 3 of Somebody Somewhere, Andrew Means' favourite TV show of the moment. Have you ever been tempted to get properly into script writing?
I've written screenplays like over the years, but I haven't had anything made, but I've written screenplays over the years. I'm about to start work on the development of the screenplay for Best Friends. I'm working with a filmmaker called Connor Ferguson, whom you might know about, on the early stages of developing that as a feature film. So,
and has it been picked up yet, or is this in development?
We're literally at the very first stages. We're talking to producers, and you know the long road towards development and production will begin. But there is a feeling from people that there is a film in there.
Well, hopefully we'll see it being filmed in and around Sandy Cove and Glass sometime soon. I want to bring us to your cultural buried treasure, something we always ask people. It can be anything whatsoever, and let's tell us about yours.
Well, as you can tell from what I've said today, I have a taste for work that is sort of emotional and wistful. And most of us with a taste for the emotional in literature have read Elizabeth Strout. I never shut up about Olive Kitteridge, but I wanted to maybe bring someone to the listener's attention who was sort of in that kind of realm. It was a tie between the work of Amy Bloom, but I've gone for the American writer Robin Black and her collection of stories, If I Loved You, I Would Tell You This. It's a collection of stories that really, as far as I'm concerned, makes you happy to be alive. Even if there's pain along the way, you're happy to be alive. And in fact, the closing story in the collection is called The History of the World. And I would direct people to read the collection from start to finish. But the closing story, it starts with a brother and a sister going on a road trip in Europe. They're American, so driving on the European roads is a difficulty, and something happens. But the characters go, like, in the same way as they do in Somebody Somewhere, the characters go through the ringer emotionally. But at the same time, you're finishing the story feeling more optimistic about the world. There's such tenderness all the way through it. And there's a feeling of release at the end that is almost, it's impossible to describe. And it's sort of almost impossible as a writer to bring about in a considered way. But it's definitely something I was going for in Best Friends, that feeling of catharsis and, you know, going through pain to get towards something lighter.
Well, let's have a listen to If I Loved You, I Would Tell You.
At 17... Jack Snyder's daughter is slender-faced and long of limb, and still able to startle her father with her seeming certainty about everything she thinks. They're driving along roads he doesn't yet know, on their way to meet her first seeing eye dog, and she is wearing polka-dotted sunglasses, a long jean skirt, and a shirt with the words, "If you can read this T-shirt, maybe you can tell me what it says." A kid from her school ordered them in the dozens, and Lila bought three in different shades. "You're sure they aren't identical?" she questioned her mother at the time. "I don't want my teachers thinking I never change my clothes." "Believe me, Lila," Ann Snyder said. "I don't want your teachers thinking you never change your clothes either." As Jack scans the road for signs, Lila is proclaiming to him in those certain tones of hers that if it weren't for being quite so blind and having to have one, she'd definitely never get a dog. Never. Never ever. And her father is trying to follow her, trying to respond appropriately. But thoughts of Miranda Hamilton compete with the girl's words.
And that is If I Loved You, I Would Tell You This by Robin Black, your cultural buried treasure, Andrew Meehan. You've brought in some wonderful choices. I think we can all get a sense of upbeatness from everything you've picked.
Definitely upbeatness, maybe a bit of wryness, maybe a bit of ruefulness. But there is, I mean, as I hope people will find if they read Best Friends, there is a feeling of, you know, we go through things in life, but one thing that gets us through is optimism.
Yeah, and it certainly does come true. Andrew Meehan, author of Best Friends, and potentially a movie of Best Friends coming out in the future. We'll keep an eye on that, and hopefully that project will happen. Andrew Meehan, thank you very much for being our latest member of the Culture Club.
The Last Word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.